Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Prevail, c'est chaque Genève programme pour politique.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organisé, dinero sucio.
Globale corruption. Ta brutte la démocratie.
Et ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión,
Greg
Oliar. I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Victor Rudd is here, returning to the podcast. Victor is the chair of the Committee on Foreign Affairs for the Ukrainian American Bar Association. And as you may recall, we had him on last May talking about all things Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. But that was before Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And I've been dying to get him back on the show. Really delighted that he was able to spend some time with me. Great conversation. I learned a lot, as I always do, talking to Victor. We talk about Ukrainian history. We talk about a little bit about the war, about Putin, about the U.S. policy towards Russia and how it's been kind of bad for a long time. So great conversation. I'm going to share a little bit more before we talk with Victor about something he sent me that he wrote. Before that, just a few quick notes up front. News from this week, Kenneth Starr died, or if you will, was recalled to hell for reassignment. Yeah, this is Brett Kavanaugh's guy, his mentor, the guy that did the impeachment of Clinton and made it into this trashy, gross thing, defended Epstein, you know, turned a blind eye towards rape, as the headline in the Rolling Stone obituary pointed out. Just not a very good person. And end of an era, one hopes, in DC politics. Moving across the pond, the Queen is still dead. The funeral marches on. I don't know if it's ever going to end. Charles III is the new king. I don't know why he chose to stick with the name Charles. The first two kings named Charles didn't really go well for them, you know. The first one, Charles I, got beheaded, which is never, you know, what you want if you're the king. It's basically the only thing that can go wrong. And the second one was this fop who was wildly unpopular. So I don't know. Maybe he's going to turn the tide against the name, but I think he should have picked a different name. And there's so many interesting, cool names. He could have been Ethelstan II. He could have been Edred II, Edwig II. He could have been, no, not Queen Anne. he could have been Queen Anne. That would have been fun. He could have been, here we go. He could have been Canute II, and Canute is, spelled in the Scandinavian country, C-N-U-T, which would have been no end to the jokes. He could have been, this was the perfect name. In 978 to 1016, there was a king named Ethelred the Unready. He could have been Ethelred II, and we could have called him Ethelred the Ready, because he spent 60 fucking years getting ready to be king, right? That would have been totally cool and perfect and funny and appropriate. And But maybe he's not ready. I mean, he doesn't seem like the kind of king that is going to get shit done. He's kind of an effete king, the kind of king that people don't like. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Charles III. I don't think it's going to end well for him or the monarchy as everything continues to splinter away. Speaking of monarchs, I have an announcement. I have a book out. Well, it's coming out. I think you can go buy it now, right this very second on Amazon. It is called Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay. And it's something I wrote in 2015, 2016. It's a historical thing. And I was, you know, trying to get it published, doing the things that you do. And then all the Trump stuff happened and I kind of put it in my drawer. So I guess in an effort to reclaim my old life back in the days when I used to write novels and fiction and do that kind of thing, I decided, fuck it, I'm just going to put the book out. So it's out. It's called Empress. It's available on Amazon. And as a special treat, at the end of the podcast, after the credits, if you stick around, there is an audio of the preface, the introduction, and the first chapter of my new book. So stick around for that. Hopefully you'll like it. Yeah, I'm excited about it. I'm nervous about it. It's weird. I haven't had a book out in a long time. I forgot that. Like, when the Knicks went to the playoffs 2 years ago, they hadn't been to the playoffs in like 20 years, and I was watching the game, and I got like all into it and nervous, and my stomach was in knots, and I'm like, oh, I forgot that when your team, you know, when your team is in the playoffs, you feel this way. And I feel the same way about the book coming out. I forgot that putting a book out is actually horrible. So anyway, please be gentle. I like the book a lot. I think it's really good. I think it's the best thing in that form that I've ever done. I was super excited when I was writing it. And, you know, hopefully that comes through. So if you're interested, stick around after the credits. If you're not, there's no way for me to know. That's fine. I'm not going to hold it against you. Okay, so Victor's going to come on in a minute. He sent me this thing he wrote, sort of a list that he's sending to lots of people, titled Ukraine is Pivotal to America's Global Security. And there's a bunch of notes that he hits, and I'm just going to read them up front, just so people get. Ukraine is not Afghanistan or Iraq. This is not a civil war, but an invasion by the largest country on earth. America has provided Ukraine with 1% of the aid it buried in Afghanistan. Ukraine is not Russia or part of Russia. We cover that in the podcast kind of up front. Ukraine is the largest country in Europe, the size of England, Germany, Hungary, and Israel combined. Ukraine is one of the oldest European democracies with the first democratic constitution. There's branches of government, separation of church and state, and it was 77 years before the American constitution. Ukraine, reclaiming its independence in 1991, ensured the collapse of the Soviet Union, allowing the United States to declare that it won the Cold War. Could not have won the Cold War without this happening. Seems important. Ukraine surrendered the world's third largest nuclear arsenal back at the time, larger than that of China, Britain, and France combined. Now, this is something people don't, I think, realize, that they had nukes and gave them up. Destruction of Ukraine's sovereignty is a core postulate in Russia's total warfare doctrine against the West, and most specifically the United States, going back at least to 1997. Defense Minister Shoigu is clear, quote, Russia can't afford to lose the information war. How do you win? He spelled it out long ago, by undermining the political, economic, and social system, mass indoctrination of the population for destabilizing society and the state, and forcing the state to take decisions in the interests of the opposing party. Seems like what's happening here, right? Securing Ukraine's independence will be a counterweight to Russia, allowing us to address China. Ukraine is a founding member of the UN and internationally recognized. Ukraine has been a staunch ally of the US in our war on terror, providing troops and rescuing refugees under circumstances that the US and NATO could not. Ukrainian survival is crucial to the world's food supply. This is a big one. There's a lot of nuclear power plants in Ukraine, and if something goes wrong there, we're all fucked. That's not what he wrote. I'm just paraphrasing. Now, Russia's been occupying the Chernobyl nuclear power plant site. Radiation's leaking can become a repeat ecological disaster for the world. This is also something that my friend Zarina Zabriskie has been on almost from the gate. The West walked away from Ukraine before. In 1932 to 33, Moscow broke the back of Ukrainian resistance by starving millions, dehumanizing as mere ethnographic mass. Raphael Lemkin, the father of the UN Genocide Convention, condemned it as classic genocide. Today, Russia calls to kill all Ukrainians are vitriolic. So basically, we didn't, you know, part of this is because Durante and the Times did shitty reporting, but we didn't recognize what was happening in Ukraine at the time, and we just let the Soviet Union into basically the good graces of the world without any consequences at all. Russia already controls Ukraine's Black Sea jurisdiction that is larger in area than South Korea and has made claims in the past against Alaska. The U.S. is historically a seafaring nation where the law of the sea must remain paramount. The rules-based international order was forged by the horrors of the 20th century. Ukraine lost more humanity than any other country in World War II, more than the military losses of the U.S., Canada, the British Commonwealth, France, Italy, Germany, and Japan combined. Ukraine had more military personnel fighting Nazi Germany than the U.S. Army in Europe. After World War II in Europe, in Operation Keelhaul, the U.S. forcibly and with deadly force repatriated hundreds of anti-Soviet Ukrainian refugees back to the Soviet Union and their death. Sanctions don't work with Putin. They simply put a price tag on invasion and occupation, but they do not prevent it. Again, this is something we get into in the podcast. Do America's sacrifices in the wars of the 20th century have a price tag? They will not remove Russia from Ukraine. And then Victor, and again, I've been reading this sheet that Victor gave me, quotes Karl Marx, "The ignorance, the laziness, the pusillanimity, the perpetual fickleness and credulousness of Western governments enabled Russia to achieve successively every one of her aims." Obviously, he didn't say that last week, but, you know, he may as well. So those are the points that he wanted to stress. I just wanted to read them up front, kind of in a list. We get into a lot of this stuff during the interview. I was super happy to have him back. So without further ado, we'll be right back with Victor Rudd.
Do you got a lot of shit to get from point A to point B, but don't trust the no good sons of bitches at Mayflower? Hi, I'm Nunzio Ciccarelli, president of the Bada Bing Moving Company. Whether you're relocating from D.C. to Palm Beach, shipping pallets of laundered cash, or hauling a coffin full of classified documents from your church to your golf course, Bada Bing can help. We got a huge fleet of trucks and the best muscle in the business. Plus, none of our wise guys got a big fucking mouth. No credit, no problem. Bada Bing Moving Company. When we haul, you don't take the fall. And now, back to the show.
Victor Rudd, welcome back to the Prevail Podcast.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you. I learned so much from you last time you were on. It was way back May 21st of last year. I've, you know, listened to what you said, read your stuff, and basically ran with those talking points for the last year and a half, especially pertaining to the war. But I've been really eager to get you back on the show to get your take on what's happening there. Not so much in the small picture, but in the big picture and in the historical sort of sweep of things. Before we get going, you mentioned we spoke yesterday. You mentioned you gave an address or a speech at West Point. I just wanted to ask about that. How did that come about, and how was it for you to talk, you know, to the cadets?
Oh, it was great. It was a mixed group, mostly senior graduating cadets. We had several people. One of the persons who flew in from Germany was former Ben Hodges, former General Ben Hodges, former commanding general of the U.S. Army and NATO for several years. He retired a couple of years ago, lives in Frankfurt. He came in. He's very, very good. He's been a commentator for a lot of news programs. And, you know, it was sort of straddling the military civilian issues that may be encountered when and if the war ever ends. But it was good. I gave them a perspective that they hadn't heard before, basically the notion of self-deterrence that we're subjecting ourselves to. And my view being that the safest and quickest end to this was to do what should have been at that time and even now, no-fly corridors and the like to secure or to reduce civilian casualties, to ensure shipments of grain through the Black Sea. A lot of the Ukraine's agricultural output goes to Africa and third world countries. They are particularly susceptible to food warfare that Putin is waging. Well, on balance, it was good. I was actually asked to come there. I guess this is one of your first questions. I was asked to come there indirectly by Ben Hodges, who I got to know when I talked in Europe, and he and I were at a conference together.
That's great. And good that they had you there because, you know, like I said, I've learned a lot from you. I know the listeners have. Now, it's been a while since you were on. I don't want to spend the whole time talking about the stuff we talked about last time, but I think up front, we should cover it. Again, the history of Ukraine vis-a-vis the history of Russia, how the Soviets in particular, but even the Tsarist regimes before that, kind of took it upon themselves as a big disinformation campaign to make it seem like Ukraine is just the little brother, the sort of offshoot of what was there first, when in fact, you know, Kyiv has been there for much longer than Moscow, and all of this civilization sort of began there. Can you give us just a little bit of historical background?
Sure. Let me let me make a prefatory comment that the problem with all this and trying to discuss it, particularly with an informed and educated crowd, is that our learning, what we know and understand of, let's call it Russia in quotation marks, and I would include the Soviet Union in that, although that's very, very different. You know, the educational basis for that in the West was established by Russian historians and academics who fled the Russian Empire after Lenin's coup d'etat in 1917. And they established the basis for what we call Russian studies in the West. At the major universities, the Sorbonne and Oxford and Cambridge in Europe, and preliminarily Columbia, Yale, and Harvard in the United States, and then it spread out elsewhere. And basically, the imperial history was, as you said, and as I mentioned earlier, they were looking for a legitimate pedigree, which was Kievan, the Kievan Rus state, and R-U-S, unfortunately, because it sounds like Russia or the first syllable of Russia. The conclusion very often is, well, if it's RUS, then it is Russia, right? I mean, in the English language, at least. So, you know, that's one of the starting points for the view that the genesis of Russia was in Kyiv, and it was not. And now what we have and what Putin has promoted, and unfortunately what pervades in the West still, although it's changing, is the notion that with Kyiv as the genesis, then Ukraine is a splinter and Russia has to recoup it. Of course, if you think about it for a second critically, it really ought to be the other way around, right? If Kyiv and Ukraine was the beginning of it all, then it is Russia that Ukraine should recoup, and we should be seeing an invasion by the home country, Ukraine, of Russian territories trying to recoup it as originally Kyiv Rus territories. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but let me just give you one example. Let's analogize the Roman Empire. If we analogize the Roman Empire to the Kievan Rus state in the Middle Ages, the largest political entity in Europe, and if Kyiv is Rome, right, and the Roman Empire included a multitude of countries in Europe and elsewhere that we know today as Spain, France, Germany, England, and today's Romania, for example.
Yep.
Then the analogy would be today's Russia is as Romania is today, right? Russia took on the Rus name as Romania took on the Rome name. Romania adopted a Latin language, which was the lingua franca of the Roman Empire. And for Russia today to say that the beginning of Russian history is Kyiv would be like saying that Romanian history begins in Rome, or French history begins in Rome, or Spanish history begins in Rome, right? It's backwards. It's a reversal of cause and effect and a reversal of historical chronology. So any country that is part of the Roman Empire could claim that Italians really are that country, right? Italians are really Romanians, or Italians are really Spaniards, or Italians are really Englishmen. So that is the fallacious basis of the claim that Ukrainians, well, they're little Russians, so on and so forth. That has prevailed so deeply in our psyche that to challenge that is very, very difficult. Fortunately, there are academics actually who are on the other side of the barricade, so to speak, but a former professor of mine, Ed Keenan at Harvard, I had debates with him on this issue as an undergrad, And he actually came around and wrote a fantastic piece explaining the mythologies that prevail in the West about Russian history and Ukraine. So that's essentially the long and the short of it. We're still burdened with this notion that Ukraine is not like Italy, France, Germany, or England, that somehow Ukraine really is, quote unquote, naturally Russian.
Right.
That is a massive, visceral, subliminal impediment to our grasping of the essence of it. But then, why do we have this war? Why do we have a truly genocidal war by Russia against Ukraine? Why did we have Stalin's starvation of Ukraine during the Soviet days? Why did we have the tremendous repressions if Ukrainians are Russians? I mean, it's counterintuitive from the get-go.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's just a little recap. I mean, I could go deeper into it, but I guess we've got other issues to it.
No, that's good. And that's I think it's important. And I think, you know, I do think that this, it's interesting how certain things penetrate the Fox News bubble and certain things don't. Most things don't. You know, COVID didn't. But for whatever reason, the war in Ukraine seems to have done that. You could tell back when the State of the Union happened, even the Republican lawmakers were wearing the Ukrainian flag pins, which right. tells you that they felt it was important to message to the voters that they were for the Ukrainians against the Russians, which I thought was interesting. What I want to ask you, we talked a little bit about this yesterday offline, is the history of the United States vis-a-vis Russia, Soviet Union, and these sort of inflection points where had the United States government, had Washington acted differently or had a different policy towards Stalin, towards Khrushchev or whoever during this course of the Soviet Union. And then again, in the 90s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, things would be very different right now. So I want to ask you about those. What are those inflection points? Where did we mess up?
It boils down to, in my estimation, to two or three specific incidents and or events or timelines. We approached the reconstruction of the old Russian Empire without regard to the fact that it was, as any empire is, a multinational state. The Soviet Union, which was simply a new moniker that was placed on a reconstructed Russian Empire that, of course, fell apart during World War I. The various nations and nationalities declared independence. Unfortunately, Woodrow Wilson's 14 points didn't extend to the nations of the Russian Empire, including Ukraine. Ukraine was divided into four different countries. It was split up. Largest chunk was given to Russia, despite the warnings that the Ukrainian delegation to the Paris Peace Conference that there was going to be a problem, and Russia is intent on reoccupying Ukraine, controlling the Black Sea, access to the Mediterranean, so on and so forth. So our notion, the governing notion, was that we are dealing with Russia, basically a unitary country. As any country, it has its minorities, it's got its ethnics, so on and so forth. People are, you know, the marginalized people, they're not very happy, but no notion of the centrifugal force of any empire. Western empires have collapsed, right? The Habsburg Empire, the British, the French, all the empires have gone essentially down the drain. And yet the Russian Empire was reconstructed with, ironically, American money, American capital. We extended diplomatic recognition to the Soviet Union on November 16th, 1933, precisely at the time that Stalin was starving Ukrainians. Millions were starved to death. Why? Well, for the very purpose of breaking the back of resistance to Russian reoccupation. And the fact of the matter is, of course, that continued until the fall of the Soviet Union in 1990-91. And it was the final death blow, if you will, to that was Ukraine's reclaiming of its independence that it had asserted back in 1918. You had just mentioned very briefly, you know, the Republican Party here, and it is ironic. Actually, I'm starting an article on this. It's ironic that President Reagan, whose legacy is basically he catalyzed events that eventually led to the fall of the evil empire, and that is not a hackneyed phrase. That really is what it was. It was a vast necropolis that extended not only into Eastern Europe and internally within the Soviet Union. And he recognized what no other policymaker understood, which was the multinational structure of the Soviet Union and what that portends for us and for our security. And he supported Ukrainian independence very strongly. Of course, that didn't come about until after his presidency. And ironically, the Republicans, George Bush, pulled back on that. The Republican administration, unfortunately, was not very eager to support American Ukrainian independence or indeed the independence of any non-Russian republic. But it came to pass anyway. So that's on the opposite end of the spectrum. And in between, we had policies, you know, all good intent aside. For example, our radio broadcasting Voice of America and the like to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, although we had language broadcasting that was geared toward the non-Russian nations. Basically, we still saw it as a Russian empire, and it was just a question of trying to get along with them. We had no intent to bring about the fall of the USSR until President Reagan was inaugurated. Our attempt was simply to live and let live. And of course, our strategic slide, look where we were after World War II and where we were in the late 1970s, early 80s. Our prominence was lost in the world generally and vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Ironically, we recaptured that prominence when the Soviet Union fell apart. We were as close as we could be in the world globally in terms of global security posture, as close as we could have been to where we were after World War II. And look where we are now. We have had one failure after the other, and frankly, under both administrations, to secure the independence and the viability and the democracy of the non-Russian nations. We have it in the Baltic countries, fortunately. They're members of NATO. Belarus is still under a dictator, and Ukraine right now is on the cusp. It can go either way, but if it goes the wrong way, then we now have the multiplier effect with China, Iran, North Korea. So Ukraine is vitally, vitally important because of its, as I say, the multiplier effect if it goes south.
It sounds like also just thinking through the inflection points of history that a lot of the problems that we had or the mistakes that we made are because of the idea of containment, but also either underestimating Stalin or taking him at face value. I think at the end of the, you know, FDR was much more willing to go along with him and live and let live, I think, than, for example, Churchill was.
Yes.
At the end of the war, as far as I know, Churchill wanted to keep going and take Stalin out, and you know, everybody else was tired of it. I don't know that that would have worked. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but that sort of put it on hold. Then you go through to the other times, you know, you have the Cuban Missile Crisis with Kennedy trying to posture. But and that, I think, led directly to the Vietnam conflict, because as I read it, Kennedy's failures in Berlin and elsewhere to kind of present himself as a viable alternative to the evil empire didn't work, and he felt like the only way to do that was via these proxy wars. And this whole the domino theory, you know, is it true? Is it not true? I don't know, but that was what informed Vietnam and a lot of policy for a couple of decades there. And then you know, you mentioned the fall of the Soviet Union, and then the Yeltsin years when Bill Clinton was there. I mean, Bill Clinton once referred to Yeltsin as the Abraham Lincoln of Russia, which in retrospect is just, you know, preposterous. I mean, Lincoln didn't drink that much. So the idea of containment, I think, maybe it was a mistake to think about it that way, you know, to contain it. Maybe something else should have been.
Well, yeah, a couple observations on that. I've written extensively on it. As a matter of fact, after Reagan's inauguration, a member of his foreign policy transition team asked me to submit a critique and a proposal to Richard Allen, who was President Reagan's first national security advisor back in 1981. I captioned it Beyond Containment. And the problem we have with containment, it was implemented or formally adopted by President Truman in 1949. So it took us 4 years after the occupation of Eastern Europe by Stalin for us to come out of our torpor. But the problem with containment is it is necessarily and exclusively a responsive, reactive approach to dealing with things. We abdicated the selection of time, place, and intensity of conflict to Moscow, basically outsourced our foreign policy to Moscow. Moscow would choose what would happen when, where, and how, and we would respond. And the analogy would be basically to say that the only way to deal with a pyromaniac is to build a very large, expensive mobile fire department, run around the world, putting out fires, and with no end in sight. There was no thought. Actually, it was prohibited by the terms of the containment policy to do anything affirmative to exploit and stress the Soviet Union internally and to allow for its internal weakening. And that is where, again, Reagan's approach really was an apostasy. He abandoned containment and basically, you know, set the goal of weakening the Soviet Union, primarily economically, through the arms race and other measures. And that already stressed a hugely stressed empire that had fractured, was fracturing. And the final blow, as I said, was Ukrainian independence. So now you got to ask yourself, well, Putin declared many times, more than once, it wasn't just in April of 2005 that he said famously that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest political tragedy of the 20th century. He said that in February of the year prior to that. When he said that, we yawned. Nobody paid attention. When he celebrated Stalin's birthday, when he was still head of the FSB, before he was president in 1999, nobody paid attention. When he brought back the Soviet star on military equipment, the melody of the Soviet anthem, when he relabeled Soviet military holidays as Russian holidays, you know, Russian Armed Forces Day instead of Soviet Armed Forces Day. So his drive, crazy, real, unrealistic, whatever label you want to put on it, his drive to reconstruct was there. All the indicia were there. That's what one of the things that prompted my letter to Condoleezza Rice back in 2004, ahead of her Senate confirmation hearings. I warned her of what was coming. His first goal was either to suborn Ukraine totally, and if he failed, he was going to invade. And if he invaded, how we reacted to that would determine our global credibility, again, going back to the leverage factor, our credibility with Korea, China, Iran, adding, of course, that it was President Clinton that stripped Ukraine of its nuclear arsenal. So we have this whole catalog of events and circumstances that went right over our head. We were just oblivious. You know, we pushed, there's a lot of argumentation by the commentators. It's almost comical that we pushed Russia into this in Ukraine, that we were pushing NATO, so on and so forth. Well, everybody forgets that Russia was invited to join NATO. NATO disarmed after the fall of the Soviet Union. We pushed Russia. We recouped for Russia the Soviet seat on the UN Security Council. We got Russia into the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. We got them into the G7, became the G8. A lot of that under both, well, either Democratic or Republican administrations. And the last big push was President Clinton getting Russia into the G7, making it the G8 in 1997, which was precisely the year that Alexander Dugin published his treatise for the takedown of the United States. Exploit separatist movements, exploit civil unrest, racial issues, and take advantage of the isolationist trends in the Republican Party and make the American conservative right an unwitting vehicle in all of this. You read what he said in 1997, you read what's happening now, and you got to scratch your head. How come we weren't taking it seriously? At the same time he was writing this, we were promoting Russia. We are always playing catch up. That's our problem. And we don't extrapolate. We don't know our history enough to be able to identify patterns of behavior that will allow us to extrapolate for the future and establish a strategic thought process to prepare us for what's coming down the road and to form what's coming down the road. We tend to live in a bit of a cocoon here in the U.S. and we're a little bit more concerned about the Kardashians and you know, Tide Pods than what's going on in the world.
Well, today, you know, it's going to be the Queen's the fallout from the Queen dying is going to be on CNN for the next month, probably, you know, apart from all the other news. We have a lot more to talk about. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Victor Rudd.
Men cannot know the anguish of being ruled ineligible on anatomical grounds beyond one's control. Slaves can perhaps understand, eunuchs too, and perhaps even those doomed nobles like the deposed Emperor Romanos Diogenes, whose eyes have been put out, but not men.
This podcast is brought to you by Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay, the new book by Greg Oliar, now available on Amazon.
If the truth is ever to be told, I am the only one left to tell it, and tell it I must.
Okay, we're back with Victor Rudd. I have the word Crimea written on my notes here. I want to talk about that for a second because I wrote between the time that you and I spoke last, I wrote a piece basically comparing what Putin was doing to what Hitler did in the lead up to the Second World War. Seems to me that the Crimea was very much like when Hitler took the Sudetenland. You know, the same kind of thing, the fabrication of excuses. Oh, the Ukrainians are treating the Russian speaking people badly, which is bullshit. You know, that kind of thing as an excuse to do it. Then it the election of some bogus government there, and then it's annexation. And then critically, the West doesn't do anything. You know, there's a couple of sanctions, slaps on the wrist that they probably laughed about while they were doing vodka shots in Moscow. And then, you know, this invasion of Ukraine is basically like, OK, now we're going to go into Poland here. So, you know, it's the parallels are really there's more than that, too. But the parallels are really ominous. And, you know, at least say this about Chamberlain. He didn't have the benefit of a prior example of what appeasement looks like. And, you know, the great Churchill line, which is an appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile, hoping that he'll eat him last, which is one of the many, many brilliant things that he said. So do you see it that way? I mean, do you see the parallels here or am I reaching?
Yeah, no, Greg, you put your finger on it. And, you know, the real tragedy is, you know, if you ever go down to Arlington National Cemetery and you look at what we have there and who's resting in the ground, you look at the sacrifices that we paid throughout the 20th century, but primarily World War II, because in the aftermath of World War II is, of course, when we established, it was primarily America's lead, established the international institutions to ensure something like that doesn't happen again. The rules of the road, as we say, and rule number one is the stop sign, the red light. You don't invade another country. You don't cross border. You don't annex territory, right? That is, you know, armed aggression is, you know, crime number one, both in the UN Charter, under international law, and generally so on and so forth. So what we have with Crimea, and this war, actually, you know, people are saying, well, the invasion and war started in February of this year. No, it started 8 years ago in February of 2014, February 20th, exactly. And our non-reaction to what happened in Crimea and then the subsequent invasion of Eastern Ukraine at the time.
Yeah.
That was the fuel on the fire. If we, on the one hand, can beat our chest and engage in florid, billowing cliches about the rules-based international order on the one hand, and actually do nothing to demonstrate our credibility and to enforce that, then how in the world do you expect Putin to behave? I mean, look, let's not blame Putin 100%. All right. There's another player to this, and it is basically, you know, what I'll call Western democracy sleepwalking into potential disaster and, you know, off the edge. I mean, we have been slammed on the Richter scale by a country that is 140 million people and has nothing to offer the world other than what exactly? Nothing. Right. And yet we have half of the world economy with NATO countries, so on and so forth. So going back to Crimea, it probably would have been better not to do anything, nothing, than to impose minute petty sanctions equivalent to prohibiting Putin from traveling to Disney World. Because the fact of imposing petty sanctions reinforced that we're not going to do anything else. And we really didn't do anything. The West didn't do anything until MH17 was blasted out of the sky in July of 2014. Then people started to wake up. Europe woke up because citizens from European countries were killed on that flight, almost 300 people, including American citizens. But basically, between then and February 24th, nothing of what we sought to do was geared toward preventing Putin from doing something worse. And as a matter of fact, what we did was to encourage him even more, if that's possible. How could we have done, and why did we do even more to encourage him? Well, good question, but this is what happened. Some people who have been following this are familiar with what are called the Minsk Accords. These were discussions started off as ceasefire agreements, but basically recognized Russia's right to dictate to another sovereign country. And by the way, Ukraine was a founding member of the United Nations, all right? Never mind, it was a Soviet republic, so on and so forth. But I'm going to get into this a little bit later on, maybe in the program, because I'd like to talk a little bit about Taiwan, China, and the other despots around the world that we have to deal with, yep, and the impact of Ukraine on all of that, right? But the Minsk Accords, Russia wanted to control Ukraine. The way they were going to do it was to force Ukraine to change its constitution, to give these territories in eastern Ukraine a veto on what Ukraine did, particularly in the foreign policy area. And basically, you now have a proxy statelet controlled by Moscow. We agreed to that. We agreed. President Biden, at the Geneva Conference in June of last year, agreed to the Minsk Accords and wanted them implemented. Why should Putin at that point agree to two cookies in the bottom of a cookie jar if he can get the entire cookie jar? If he sees that kind of obliviousness, then why not go for the whole thing? Now, to his credit, the Biden administration has come around tremendously. And it does deserve a lot of credit for finally waking up to the danger, pulling people together, pulling NATO together, getting our allies on board, because our overseas structure and posture, unfortunately, after the Trump administration was very, very tenuous. I mean, it was on the skids. So, you know, going back to Crimea, yes, I'll add one other element to the picture is very simply that we spoke earlier about this notion of Ukraine being in the minds of people, even though they will not articulate it, perhaps somehow really Russian, right? Well, even more so, perhaps Crimea. Well, you know, Crimea is a peninsula, part of Ukraine, originally settled by the Greeks and then by the Romans. After the Mongol invasion of Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, when Kyiv was destroyed, the remnants of that branch of the what we call the Golden Horde settled in Crimea, and they became the indigenous people. And they were persecuted terribly by Stalin as well. But Crimea became, in Soviet times, Crimea became the playground of the Soviet elite. That is where the top party and KGB and military retirees went to. It was the Florida. And it became heavily, heavily Russified for that reason. The indigenous people and Ukrainians were being pushed aside. It became exclusively a Russian language. Ukraine had to give it an autonomous status within the status of Ukraine as a sovereign state. But of course, that was not enough for Russia, and they wanted it back. So, and that is, of course, Lord Tennyson, the charge of the Light Brigade. Well, that was, you know, the battle in Crimea, Balaclava. That's all in Crimea. There's a lot of history there. But the Russians took it under Catherine II. You know, they invaded, they grabbed it, they took it away from Turkey, which had some jurisdiction there, and so on and so forth. But Russian rule of Crimea, number one, wasn't as long as you think it is. And number two, Well, like, so what? So one country rules another piece of territory, which isn't its place in the first place. And the mere passage of time then is supposed to give that invading country a dominion and authority over that piece of territory, even though it's not his, right? That's ridiculous.
Well, the other piece about Crimea and all of this is the idea of deterrence. I think that we talked about this yesterday, that the reason Putin is able to get away with all this stuff with his shit awful military capabilities and his terrible soldiers and his awful generals getting their asses kicked is because they have nuclear weapons. And Ukraine does not, because Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. And was it 96? Is that what it was? Or 94? Yes. Yeah. So, and, you know, they gave up the nuclear weapons under the idea that, you know, Russia wouldn't invade and that we would kind of like help them if such a thing happened, which, you know, I wonder what the deal is with that anyway. I mean, based on how everything else in Russia operates, I mean, do these missiles even work? Is it a real threat? And even if it is, we're just going to let this guy run roughshod over the entire planet because he has some nuclear weapons. Like, okay, he invades Ukraine now. What happens if he invades? Forget about NATO. You know, where would the line be drawn? Yeah. You know, we wouldn't let him just waltz into New York just because he has nukes, right?
Yeah. Now, Greg, you're hitting it right on the head. Ukraine, of course, is not a NATO member, but the issue of nuclear intimidation, just think about it for a second, right? Let's say you're sitting in Pyongyang, you're sitting in Beijing, you're in Tehran, and you see the United States and the NATO allies who have nuclear weapons, England and France, essentially being intimidated. Now, let me say preliminarily, because I don't want this to come back and somebody's going to say, well, you know, you got to take it seriously. I'm taking it seriously. I mean, nuclear war is, you know, that's the end, right? So let's make sure nobody gets off the track here thinking that what I'm suggesting is that we should not be concerned and we should not be cautious and we should not be prudent, right? But look at the precedent we're establishing. If the mere missile rattling works and reduces what we should otherwise be doing in Ukraine, then that holds true with threats to a NATO country. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference that the Ukraine is a part of NATO. The fear of nuclear war and the intent to avoid it at all costs almost would hold true any place else in the world. Countries who do not have nuclear weapons will want to get some somehow. Ukraine surrendered an existing massive nuclear arsenal. This was not Iran, where we're talking about a prospective acquisition of a nuclear weapon. Ukraine had it. And Russia's control of Ukraine, that's where Russia made the missiles that threatened Cuba, excuse me, that threatened the United States in Cuba in 1962. We required Ukraine to surrender everything back to Russia. There is only one study that I am aware of done by the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, 1993, where a young naval lieutenant said, this is going to be disastrous. We are oblivious to the risk that we're causing by making Russia the sole nuclear inheritor of the Soviet nuclear arsenal and without at the same time anchoring Ukraine as a point of stability and counterweight to Russia. If Russia can recoup its dominance over Ukraine, we're screwed. I mean, that's basically almost in those words. It's the only study that I found, and this is back in 1993, right?
Yeah.
And we lost. We just didn't do it. I'm afraid that our credibility posture, you know, Ukraine right now is an opportunity for us to recoup what we lost in Afghanistan. Forget leaving or staying in Afghanistan, but how the optics, the impression of American reliability and credibility. All you have to look is, right, look at the videos out of Afghanistan at the end. Ukraine for us offers the opportunity to recoup a lot of that. You know, how many trillions did we spend in Afghanistan? How many, you know, what are we spending in Ukraine? $50-60 billion. The Cold War, I just read an estimate 2 days ago that the cost of the Cold War was approximately $13 trillion. Now, it's more impressive to say $13,000 billion. $1,000 billion is a trillion, right?
Yep.
It's more impressive to talk about $13,000 billion. Well, the Cold War ended because of Ukraine. $13,000 billion, the Cold War ended. Soviet Union fell apart. So you would think that tossing $20, $50, $100, $200 billion compared to $13,000, $15,000 billion is a no-brainer. And yet we see the arguments today precisely on the cost factor. That's inane. I really don't know what's happening to a lot of people and their assessment of what's going on. Maybe they just don't know what the hell they're talking about. And I think it's got to be that, because the history is clear and the facts are clear. North Korea will never, ever surrender its nukes. Neither will China. And the only thing we can do, and what we should do, is make sure that even a non-nuclear assault is going to be resisted. And if it's not prevented, it's going to be overcome. Let's look at Taiwan just for a second. I don't want to go on and on and on in a monologue, but let me just finish a train of thought here. Taiwan is not an internationally recognized country. It's not a member of the UN. We de-recognized it ages ago. Ukraine is a sovereign, internationally recognized country, a member of the UN. Taiwan has none of the geopolitical consequences for us in terms of the history that Ukraine has, bringing down the Soviet Union, the surrender of nuclear arms, so on and so forth. And we also have the moral issue of facilitating Moscow's control over Ukraine during the famine, the forced repatriation of famine survivors after World War II, and so on and so forth. We don't have on that on the other side of the ledger with Taiwan. So if the United States walks away from Ukraine, how is China going to assess our credibility about Taiwan? I mean, Taiwan is a fraction of the size of Ukraine. The territorial waters, an exclusive economic zone in the Black Sea that was owned by Ukraine and now occupied by Russia, is the size of all of South Korea. You know, people have to take a look at a map and get some idea of the geography and orders of magnitude of what we're talking about, the precedent. And it's this precedent that Putin, China, Korea, and others know, and they're extrapolating lessons from it. We are not. We are too narrowly focused. We don't know our history, and we can't prepare for the future.
Well, we promised to protect Taiwan at the end of the Second World War, I think, or soon after that, at a time when many of the people in the United States today were not even alive. If we won't honor some commitment to help Ukraine out from the 90s, and as you mentioned, that's a much more strategical country, it's much more important, and it's in Europe, and people in the United States, for various reasons, identify more strongly with European countries than they do in Taiwan. I can't see any, I mean, if China invades Taiwan and we are called up in the United States to defend Taiwan, that's a really, really hard sell for an American public that is completely ignorant of world events. I don't think that it would happen at all. I really don't. And China probably doesn't either. Japan, yes. But Taiwan, I don't know. I don't know. To your point, I think you're right. And I think they are looking at it. And the only thing, I don't want to get into the Chinese thing here. I think the only thing that's preventing it is that the economics of China and the economics of the United States are so closely entwined at this point that I don't know that it helps them to screw us over too badly and put us in that position. I hope that's the hope. But I want to get back to what you were saying about Afghanistan, because I think this is an interesting point, too. when we pulled out of Afghanistan, the president of Afghanistan was on like the first plane out, right? That administration just ran immediately. They didn't stay. And the Zelensky has done exactly the opposite. He did not run. He stayed, and he stayed this entire time, and went from somebody who was, you know, again, he's a comedian on a show. Get, you know, he plays a president on a show who does reform, then gets elected as president to do the reform, finds that that's harder than he probably thought. Maybe he wasn't even going to get reelected. Then this happens. And now this guy is like, he's up there with Mandela and Gandhi and these people. I mean, he's amazing. You know, I think as a world leader and a leader of his people, so inspirational and everything else. The videos that they show occasionally of world leaders going to meet him in that square in Kyiv are, they're fascinating to me to watch, like Mitch McConnell try to navigate that space, because that, you know, that they must be scared out of their minds that they're there at all. And then everybody's watching and this and that. But I think that, you know, presidents before Zelensky, certainly the guy that built the palace and stole all the money that Manafort was working for, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have been able to invest the money in Ukraine. So what I hope happens out of this is that Russia gets kicked out of there, which, you know, we're recording this on the 10th of September on Saturday, and Ukraine is beating the shit out of Russia right now. They're chasing the orcs away in a way that I think is surprising, even a lot of military people watching this thing. Zelensky is positioned where he has now the credibility and the standing to be able to create something that world leaders are going to want to attach themselves to, honestly. Like, he's somebody we can trust, I guess. And I think that's really important, too, in addition to all the other stuff, for them to have a leader that I think, you know, that the United States can trust will do the right thing. What do you make of all the Zelensky stuff?
Well, I agree with you, Greg, but I will make a further observation that, you know, this isn't about just one person, although I think Zelensky is sort of emblematic of the commitment and the tenacity. But what has to be understood is, you know, this is not a war for territory. I mean, when you look at the coverage, you've got arrows, you've got territory, you've got occupied territory, you've got the Russians and the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians pushing them back. This is an existential, it's a war that Putin has proudly, loudly, and repeatedly declared to be a genocidal war. He has declared that Ukrainians should not exist, period, right?
Yep.
This is, in a way, it's sort of the unabashed open public declaration, sort of a takeoff on Hitler, who goes, you know, and Putin's way about it, and he doesn't care. You know, we're going to get rid of these people. They don't exist. They don't have a right to exist. And, you know, we're going to kill them. Well, that means that Ukrainians have no choice other than really to fight to the last man. You know, the former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, who, by the way, was born in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. And she said, well, you know, they want to kill us and we want to live. I don't see any compromise between those two positions. Right?
Yeah.
There is no choice. Russia is the largest country in the world. I mean, it is massive. It does not need more territory. The entirety of Ukraine is about 2.5% the size of Russia, right? So here's your sort of almost metaphysical question, if you wanted to have a course on this sometime at a university. If you're talking about the battle between democracy and freedom and tyranny and autocracy and the like, the question arises, well, what's the big deal about Ukraine? And why is Putin so exercised? Well, very frankly, because Ukraine, because it is not Russia, because the historic tradition, the mentality, and the psyche is so different from the Russian, it's the danger of contamination, of Russia catching the disease, so to speak, that Ukraine represents. And no tyrant can afford a country on its border like that. That is the Achilles heel for Ukraine. And if we, Western democracies were looking to, or looking at this truly as, the battle between the forces of light and darkness, then you would have to support Ukraine as well now for the other leverage factor, that being now its impact on Russia internally.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the other element. Now I recognize I sort of floated away, segued away from your specific focus on Zelensky.
That's okay.
But my point being that the macro, the gross issues that are floating around here, hovering over our heads here, are much, much more consequential that you would ever encounter listening to the news or the talk shows, or unfortunately now the opposition that is rising for additional funding for Ukraine. I think it's $13.7 billion or something that President Biden has requested Congress. And, the Heritage Foundation that came, the conservative think tank that came into the foreground under President Reagan is dead set against it. Conservative right is dead set against it. They're dancing on, the grave of the torchbearer of the party.
Yes, they are.
It's a tough time for us here domestically. The divisiveness and everything else, but it's spilling over now into our global security posture. And if the bad guys in the world want a roadmap on how to stir the pot in the United States in order to affect our posture globally, well, you've got a perfect example right now. What's happening? It's a tough road to hoe, and I hope that the populace generally understands enough. And that the current administration sticks to its guns, at least.
I think Biden has played this really smartly. You talked about it before, and I've talked about it on the podcast a bunch, but it's a very difficult needle to thread. Trump spent 4 years trying to blow NATO apart. Biden basically put it back together again in a week and a half or something, and emerged, I think, stronger than ever with now we have new countries coming in. But there's also the economic piece where the decision was made, let's just fucking destroy the economy of Russia and hope that, that starts to have some effect. That hasn't been quite as comprehensive as maybe we've liked to have seen, but it definitely is having some impact. And now you see, people in St. Petersburg and elsewhere in Russia, rising up vocally against Putin in a way that we didn't see even 6 months ago. So I'm hopeful for that, because the only way this is going to end is with Putin, being removed from office one way or the other. He's not going to sit back and take it. I think he's either going to have to resign, or he's going to have to, accidentally fall out of a 10th floor window, as happens there. Where do you see? I mean, and then you also mentioned the hearts and minds of people, and I think that's also what Zelensky has done so well, is sort of make himself an avatar of the good versus evil. They've done a really good job on social media and sort of pushing the coverage of this. But we're going to see some really some bad stories coming out now that, if the Russians continue to leave the East there, we're going to hear some things that even make the things that are already horrific seem like small potatoes. And, those stories do have a tendency, I think, to penetrate the bubble. I think people do care. We're not hearing about it as much as we'd like, but I do think that if people hear about it, they do care. This country, for a variety of reasons that we've discussed, does matter to a lot of Americans. That's what we've seen. And even anecdotally, talking about it with people in my life who aren't necessarily politically engaged, everybody knows what's going on there, and they're sort of horrified about it. But what do you think, looking forward, and I know it's hard, it's impossible to prognosticate this kind of stuff, what are things we should look for and mistakes that we should avoid, in the months ahead?
Well, it all boils down to not just continued support, but increased support, because we started at such a low, low level.
Yeah.
And we started so late. I mean, this has been going on for 8 years, and just because there hasn't been any coverage on it, and it, you know, to say this will sound strange, because people in their mind say, well, I haven't heard about it, I haven't seen it on the news, therefore it didn't happen. No, this stuff has been going on, not with the same intensity, but I've been following it very, very carefully, obviously, for 8 years. So it's unfortunate that it is at as late as it is. However, what we're going to have is pressure from Europe as the winter sets in. Finally, what Ukrainians and some other people have been saying, Europeans are going to see the consequences of putting the noose around their neck, the energy noose, trying to skip out of it now with Russian gas and energy being cut off. That pressure is going to come back to and onto Washington through politicians in Europe. And simultaneously, the pressure, as I mentioned, and you're aware of, the aftermath of our midterm elections and the influence of what I can only call the betrayal by the American, the conservative right. Now, that may sound like a redundancy, conservative and right, right? But you know what I mean, the right end of the conservative part. The betrayal of the legacy of the president that otherwise was respected, really, by both sides of the aisle, I think. And also concurrently embracing Putin and embracing Russia and disingenuously characterizing this as a border dispute. I mean, the caterwauling about, well, we're more concerned about securing Ukraine's border than our border with Mexico. That is such an absurd, monosynaptic, and frankly, just an idiotic argument in parallel that my mental thesaurus really hasn't found an adequate, modifier for that kind of parallel and that kind of argument. And, the argument about the money, but the thing that's the most rankling and the thing that's the most dangerous, I think, is it reflects a gross lacuna in understanding what Putin represents for us, and even a bigger failure to understand, I keep on going back to this, that precisely because we do have now other impending disasters around the globe with Iran and China, it is precisely for that reason that we have to anchor Ukraine in Europe, sort of analogously to how Israel secures, serves as a bit of an anchor in the Middle East.
Yeah.
There is a certain parallel there, but if Ukraine goes south, it'll go south because our failure of will. Capability is not the issue. The United States and Western democracies always had a military and other capability, economic one, eons above anything that Russia has. That's not the issue. The issue is using and wielding the capability, which means having the credible will to use it. Credibility of will is what establishes deterrence. And you're going to demonstrate it with more necessary aid to Ukrainians. And they have, this isn't as if we're giving computerized weaponry to, people in Afghanistan or elsewhere who don't know how to use it. I mean, Ukrainians, you talk with our military personnel, as I have with General Hodges or others, Ukrainians have been very, very adept. Ukraine is a digitized society.
Yeah.
It's a massive IT source. And what Ukrainians have done with American weaponry you know, the Pentagon says has been pretty amazing. Even our guys said, wow, you know, we never thought of that. You know, look what they're able to do. So, you know, that aspect should serve as an incentive and as affirmation of money well spent.
Yeah, well said. Now, those are all good points. One last thing about Putin, and then we can end with this. I was thinking about, like, just the whole spin, you know, the spin. You mentioned the caterwauling about the Mexico border and drawing that analogy. And Tucker Carlson seems like he's on a mission to figure out some way to defend Putin at all costs. You know, other people, too, on that network, which is poisoning the discourse, frankly. Putin's main sort of defense for this, as I saw it, at least heading into the war, was, hey, I'm afraid that we have all these NATO people all around me. They want to invade Russia, and therefore we're doing this to defend ourselves. Like that's sort of the line. It's bullshit, but that's the line that he's trotted out. And I think one thing that the situation in Ukraine has made clear is that no, we're not doing that, because if there was ever a moment when all of us were going to invade Russia, it would be now, when all of their military is in this quagmire getting its ass kicked. And they don't, I mean, as you mentioned, Russia is a vast country. How can you defend those borders? You know, if we wanted to invade, we would be in Moscow in 20 minutes. Like it's bullshit. It's clearly bullshit.
Yeah. Of all people, Putin knows and understands us and the West perfectly, perfectly well, better than we understand ourselves. Name me one person in the United States, one country anywhere in the West, where there is any thought about any kind of invasion of Russia. It's not there. But it's you know, it's made up out of whole cloth. And then our people here, you know, the Professor Mearshires of the world, then jump on that and make that same argument. It is as inane as the Mexican border, you know, Ukraine border analogy. NATO is a red herring. Finland and Sweden are joining NATO. Putin didn't bat an eyelash. And in 1992 and 93, Putin was very clear when he said, 2002 and 2003, Putin was very clear. He says, Ukraine wants to join NATO, go ahead, I don't care. He has reversed 180 degrees. We don't know our history, we don't remember it. And we get carried along on this tidal wave of fantasy. It is beyond amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the Russians pay good money for their spin to be covered. But that's a topic for another
Greg,
day.
Let me, if I can, I just picked up something that I have here. Let me quote to you the defense minister, Russian defense minister. Russia can't afford to lose the information war. We must undermine the political, economic, and social system, mass indoctrination of the population of America for destabilizing its society and the state, and force America to take decisions in the interest of Russia.
Yeah, and they've done it. I mean, they've done a hell of a job with it. You know, you look at Tucker Carlson, you look at, you know, a lot of these, the right-wing media and stuff like that, and it's out of control. I mean, they're carrying water for the guy. And a lot of our, you know, our politicians are too, sadly. I mean, it's scary and dangerous and, you know.
I mean, fortunately, I'll let me interrupt for a second. Fortunately, I mean, we can't, this is too important to be partisan. I mean, fortunately, you know, there are a lot of conservatives, you know, hopefully the bulk of the Republican Party that is still, you know, supportive. And I'm not going to say support of the Biden administration, because it's not a question of supporting the administration. It's a question of supporting the concept and the goal, right? So that is still there, but the erosion is accelerating, and that is very, very bad. I am very concerned about the midterm election. You know, people, you know, when we have people such as Congresswoman Green, the Tucker Carlsons of the world, Senator Josh Hawley.
Ron Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's scary. I agree. I do think, though, that Republican voters care. Like I said before, they care about this, which is why the politicians all wore the Ukrainian flag pins during the State of the Union address. I think they do care. I think for whatever reason, this penetrated the bubble where even COVID did not. So that's the hope. And I'm rooting for it. I hope that the war ends soon. I don't know that it will, but I hope that it does. And in the meantime, where you mentioned you're writing an article, where can people read some of the things that you've written? Where are you writing these days?
Well, right now I started focusing on The Hill, because I'm really trying to, you know, affect a little bit as much as I can that particular readership. I've had several pieces published by the Center for European Policy Analysis, which is a Washington think tank. They're very, very, very good. A lot of people that I respect, Ed Lucas, who was the former senior editor of The Economist. He's one of the primary contributors. He's active there. General Hodges. And previously, I've had my pieces in Forbes. They stopped outside contributors now, so I'm not having anything more placed now. Defense Report, just a various mix of outlets. But right now, as I said, primarily The Hill and SEPA.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I know everybody listening was grateful to hear your thoughts. And it's always, for me, a learning experience. I appreciate you hipping us to the knowledge. And I hope you come back again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Greg. Take care.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail. Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay. Introduction to the First Edition. By me, Greg Oliar. In the event that you recognize my name at all, it's almost certainly in association with my political writing. Perhaps you subscribe to my Substack, Prevail, or listen to my podcast, also called Prevail. Maybe you follow me on Twitter, where my frequent threads on Trump-Russia were widely shared during the administration of the defeated former guy, thus catapulting me from obscure novelist to obscure novelist with 190,000 followers. Nothing there hints at how I might have come into possession of the medieval manuscript you're about to read, an honest-to-God genuine artifact from the High Middle Ages. Something like this is usually published in association with an august museum or a fancy university, and shepherded by a scholar of great renown, not an English major who tweets too much. So I understand the confusion. Let me come clean. Writers, and novelists especially, like to cultivate the impression that we're well off, that we bank so much coin from book royalties that we can afford to sit around all day eating bonbons and working the Twitter machine. This is mostly fantasy. The novel, what a misnomer that, is a dying art form, like opera or ballet. The average novel sells fewer than 1,000 copies and has a total readership that would fit comfortably in the auditorium of your local high school, with the obvious exception of fiction writing royalty like Stephen King and J.K. Rowling and, I don't know, Dean Koontz and the like. Novelists must hustle to make ends meet. We teach classes in creative writing. We freelance for what few publications still pay for content. We run social media for corporate websites. We moonlight at advertising agencies. We sell real estate and life insurance. We marry investment bankers. I'm no exception. I, too, have a day job. For the last 10 years, I've worked for a wholesale company that deals in ancient coins, Greek, Roman, Crusader, and so on. I handle product development. My job is to concoct stories about the various coins to make them more appealing to our customers. For example, no one has heard of Sigismund of Luxembourg, a minor Hungarian king of the early 15th century, and thus no one much cares about the crappy little silver coin struck half a millennium ago in his long-forgotten kingdom. But
Sigismund of Luxembourg founded the Order of the Dragon, a secret society whose mission was to repulse the Turks, and which membership gave Dracula his nickname. Draculea is Romanian for little dragon. So, packaged in a snazzy Dracula box and attractively priced, these same crappy little silver coins, thousands of which had languished in our company's vault for decades before my arrival, quickly sold out. Our company is active in the ancient coin market. We buy big lots of relatively inexpensive coins, which we then wholesale to retail coin dealers. Late Roman bronzes are our bread and butter. I know so much about Constantine the Great that I could walk into a classroom right now and give an hour-long off-the-cuff lecture, the same way a car dealer could riff for hours on this or that iteration of Ford Mustang. Judean prutas, which we sell as biblical widow's mites, are also perennial bestsellers. That's usually what's on offer, and that's typically what we buy. But every so often, we come across something novel. Once we bought a lot of Norman silver deniers struck by William the Conqueror from a newbie dealer from Rouen who barely spoke English. My boss negotiated the deal in his rudimentary schoolboy French, and the agreement was literally drawn up on a napkin. That lot sold at a tidy profit a few weeks later. The Frenchman found us at the big Berlin coin show, referred to us by another dealer. Word of mouth is also how we came into possession of a hoard of medieval coins, some 3,000 total, struck by various Byzantine emperors from the late 11th through the early 12th centuries. Skyphates, or cup coins, are roughly the size of a quarter, but convex in shape like a contact lens. On one side is a portrait of Jesus Christ, on the other, the emperor, sometimes with his wife or his sons. The portraits are all rendered in that strange Byzantine style that looks like something from a medieval sci-fi comic. The coins are struck in billin, an alloy best described as bad silver. So, this particular hoard was discovered on the 2nd of September 2016 in a sealed lead pot by construction workers building a strip mall in the Zeyrek neighborhood of Istanbul. Initially thrilled at their apparent good fortune, executives at the construction company were disappointed to learn that the coins were dirt common. Byzantine skyphates in extra fine condition retail for something like $20, if you can find a willing buyer. The buried treasure wasn't much of a treasure, not to a big corporation anyway. After clearing it with the Erdogan government, the executives unloaded the lot to a Bulgarian coin dealer, a slight man with a horror movie aspect owing to his hair lip and his vampiric accent, who in turn sold it to my boss, lock, stock, and proverbial barrel, for 12,000 euro. My boss immediately flipped 1,000 of the coins to a dealer in Canada for the same price, which means that, in effect, we acquired 2,000 Byzantine coins for nothing. When the shipment arrived in our upstate New York warehouse, we were shocked to discover, inside the original container, a rolled-up stack of yellowed parchment. My boss freaked out. He was wary of getting involved with antiquities. There had been, half a decade earlier, a series of high-profile arrests of antiquities dealers of his acquaintance. Syrians living in London alleged to be fencing stolen artifacts to finance jihad, so he preferred to stick to cheap coins, which tend to move more easily through customs. When I offered to take the thing off his hands for $1,000, and, more importantly, to handle whatever paperwork was necessary to make it good with the Office of Foreign Assets Control, he happily agreed. I reached out to an old college friend, Marina Gavaris, a tenured professor of medieval studies at Georgetown, our alma mater. She's one of those freakishly brilliant people who speaks seven languages, including medieval Greek. She agreed to translate the pages, and also, critically, arrange for Dumbarton Oaks, a prominent Byzantine research library within walking distance of her office, to both finance the project and clear it with the OFAC. As part of the deal, Dumbarton Oaks would retain the physical codex when she finished with the translation, which was fine by me. For my troubles, I would get the publishing rights. Although, when I drove down to Washington to hand-deliver the thing, I had no idea what those publishing rights might involve. Marina warned me that the codex was likely nothing. An inventory of goods, a household budget, liturgical documents, something prosaic like that. When she began to read the faded Greek minuscule letters, however, her eyes widened so much, I was afraid they might pop out of her head entirely. "Holy shit!" exclaimed the learned Byzantine scholar. "Holy fucking shit!" The codex was neither inventory of goods, nor household budget, nor a liturgical document, but rather a lost manuscript by the Byzantine princess Anna Komnene. Anna, the firstborn daughter of the emperor Alexios Komnenos, is the author of the Alexiad, an exhaustive history of her father's long and eventful reign. Both princess and book are largely forgotten now, familiar only to Byzantinists, like my friend Marina, but her chronicle remains one of the finest extant primary sources on the First Crusade. The newly discovered codex, known as the Anecdota, or Secret History, is a shockingly modern companion piece to the Alexiad. The pages that follow comprise the first English-language edition of what Marina insists is one of the great literary works of the High Middle Ages. A random twist of fate led me, a novelist, to be the publisher of this remarkable work. Appropriately so, unlike the Alexiad, which is part history, part hagiography, and frankly a bit on the dull side, The Secret History reads like a novel. Perhaps that art form isn't dead after all? Here is a book, painstakingly compiled and stashed away before anyone could ever lay eyes on it, 9 centuries ago, read for the first time by a medieval scholar, a woman, which seems significant, at a university on a continent that Anna Komnene herself did not know existed, almost a full millennium later. And those faded scribbles of ink on decaying parchment, the very words and incantation, somehow have the power to restore, to reanimate, a world long since vanished. Is that mere art? Is it not closer to magic? And now, the secret history of Anna Komnene.
Preface. The stream of time will wash away the dark stain of our delible memory. Sure as the rushing river smooths the stone on its bank, no man mortal or otherwise is impervious to these relentless waters. Even the gods are forgotten. This, the astute reader will recall, was my stated motivation for writing the Alexiad, to give account of the deeds of my esteemed father, the great Emperor Alexios Komnenos. It is with some irony, then, that my own memories are refusing to wash away, or at any rate are not washing away fast enough. Time takes its time. Ancient as I am, at 69, withered and broken in my modest rooms at Ketcheradamini, I find that not an hour passes without my mind turning to the events chronicled in that book of mine, and not for the reasons one might suppose. The historian, as I wrote therein, must shirk neither remonstrance with his friends nor praise of his enemies. He is in the service only of truth. And this, more than anything, is what gnaws at me now. While I did not bear false witness, nor did I tell the full story, much was left unsaid or unremarked upon, much ignored, in order not to bestow credit upon some heroic character other than my father. The women especially I have marginalized, my irrepressible grandmother and namesake Anna Dalasine, the formidable Empress Eudokia of Macrobolidisa, and most of all the lovely Maria of Alania, who was so forthcoming in relating to me the momentous events of her incredible life. These egregious omissions fill me with shame. Of all people, I should have known not to downplay the female contributions to our proud history. It is Candlemas Day, Anno Domini 1153. John II Komnenos, my hapless half-brother and my father's unworthy successor, is 16 years dead. His flouncing son Manuel now occupies the throne, my throne, or rather the throne that would have been mine were I not of the weaker sex, the throne that should have been mine regardless. I, Anna Komnene, lost queen of the Byzantines. Men cannot know the anguish of being ruled ineligible on anatomical grounds beyond one's control. Slaves can perhaps understand, eunuchs too, and perhaps even those doomed nobles like the deposed Emperor Romanos Diogenes, whose eyes have been put out, but not men. How apposite is the scripture, Adam content in his slothful ignorance, lazy ruler of all he surveys, Eve ripe with fecund curiosity and grand ambition, Eve punished for the selfsame willful attributes gifted her by her creator. The cruel vicissitudes of fate, of which the tragedian sang so plangently, my tale is worthy of Aeschylus or Sophocles. I will not lie, it is a struggle to avoid bitterness. Tragedies often end in death, as a cursory survey of Greek drama shows, but death at least is respite from bitterness and rage and humiliation. Real tragedy is confinement to a convent, house arrest in this forgotten place. exiled to irrelevancy. The blind Oedipus, or Diogenes, wandering the earth. Impotence, celibacy, boredom, intellectual stagnation, rot. The machine of government grinds on without me entombed as I am in this mausoleum by another name. My nephew, traipsing round the Grand Palace in those ridiculous pantaloons, entertains infidels, but will not grant his aunt an audience. My own children scorn me. My friends, there were never, let us be true, very many, have all passed on. I have managed the best I could. When my husband died 12.5 years ago, he left behind fragments of a manuscript, a history he'd intended to continue to the present day, or at least through the reign of Alexios that ended in Anno Domini 1118. I picked up where he left off, although his scholarship was too shoddy to be of much use, by completing Nikephoros Perennios the Younger's history of Alexios Komnenos. I could honor both my husband and my father. This was the well-intended advice the Mother Abbess put before me. "Serve the memory of the two distinguished men who were your masters," she said. And so I did, to a degree that even my kindly Mother Abbess scarce could have imagined. The Alexiad not only far exceeds the immature scribblings of my husband, but ranks, dare I say, with the works of Herodotus and Xenophon. Certainly the blundering Zealous is not my match, as he could never resist the temptation, as I have, although I have more reason to include myself than that old fraud, to insert himself so prominently in every relevant scene. So long as the Alexiad exists, Alexios Komnenos and Nikephoros Perennios the Younger will never be forgotten. No daughter or wife has ever given greater glory to father and husband. Selflessly have I acted in composing my history, but history is not well served by selflessness. Mea culpa, I have presented a flawed account. O history, I have betrayed thee, just as I was myself betrayed by my father, by my husband, by my very anatomy. The reward of suffering is experience, the playwright wrote. But he has it wrong. It's the other way around. The reward of experience is suffering. The guilt of my literary deceit weighs heavily on me. I lie awake at night. Beneath the habit, what little hair that remains falls out in clumps. If the truth is ever to be told, I am the only one left to tell it, and tell it I must. I must atone for the sin of redaction, a sin for which neither presbyter nor patriarch can offer true absolution. Let these pages be my penance, O God. The Astrologer. At 10:30 in the morning, on the first day of the 12th month of the year of our Lord 1083, a eunuch burst out of the Porphyra and hurried into the nearby chambers of the court astrologer, an Antiochene by birth, who had served the emperors of Rome since the days of Monomachus. The astrologer was at his writing desk, ephemerides at the ready, awaiting the eunuch's arrival. "What was the time?" "Just now, sirrah." The astrologer nodded, ran his silt-brown fingers through his thick white beard, and turned to his books. That year's ephemeris first, then the well-worn copy of Claudius Ptolemy's Tetrabiblos. As he made his notations, a crooked smile broke across his grizzled brown face. After 10 minutes of furious computation, he put down his pen and exclaimed, "But God is good!" to no one in particular, as the dutiful eunuch had already returned to the Porphyra to attend to the new mother and her baby. The old man rose and practically ran down the hall to the royal apartments, dizzy with excitement. He found the emperor in the map room, anxiously pacing to and fro, wearing holes in the rugs. "What news?" the Augustus cried. "The child is born," the old man said, "and your excellency, the stars are a thing of wonder." He went on to analyze the natal chart of the emperor's firstborn and heir to the throne. "The position of Mars in the first house, so close to the horizon. Your grace, you could not ask for better placement." Mars, the astrologer explained, although the emperor was himself familiar with Ptolemy and did not require remedial instruction, was ruler of war, and thus its position on the ascendant indicated an assertive, self-confident aspect well suited to command.
This child was a natural-born leader, the sort of man others would happily follow into battle, even into certain death. Not unlike yourself, he added, in a tone of well-practiced obsequity. He had not retained his position for so long without knowing how and when to deploy blandishments. The Emperor nodded, and the old sycophant continued. And Jupiter, also so close to the horizon. Jupiter is the great benefic. This is a lucky child, Your Grace. Lucky indeed. This pleases me, the Emperor said. Thank you, Sira. That is all. The astrologer was banished to Proti the very next day, after the Emperor discovered, to his eternal disappointment given the auspicious astrological reading, that the baby crying in the Porphyra, his firstborn child and presumptive heir, was in fact a girl. The Emperor was Alexios Komnenos. The baby girl was me. By the time I was born in the purple, of course, my father was firmly ensconced on the throne, having been Augustus for 2 full years. Any lingering questions about his legitimacy had been answered with his empire saving military victories over Robert the Fox and the Normans at the beginning of his reign, of which more later. Before Larissa, however, such questions plagued him. For Alexios, let us not forget, was a usurper. That his great-uncle Isaac Komnenos had been emperor decades earlier indicated that he was of noble stock, but this in itself was not much of a claim. Alexios was not even the oldest of the Komnenoi. His beloved brother, named Isaac in homage to the former emperor, had held that distinction since the death of their eldest brother Manuel at Manzikert. Why should this upstart, this third son of the brother of a former emperor, wear the purple? Why should Alexios Komnenos, of all people, be the one to supplant the more or less rightful ruler, Botaniates? Divine providence, some would say, and surely God willed his speedy ascension. Others would credit the kingly mix of charisma, piety, cunning, and ambition that formed his personality, and certainly a lesser mortal would not have pulled it off. But the political genius who engineered the coup, who plucked my father from his post as domestic of the schools and installed him on the throne, was neither Alexios nor God. No, there was, as is often the case in the long annals of Rome, a puppet master, or mistress, as it were, just off stage, tugging at the marionette strings. My father never told me the story of the astrologer, you see. It was related to me by the other occupant of the map room on the morning I was born, when the old stargazer made his blunder. For Alexios was not alone on the 1st of December A.D. 1083. He was never alone in those days. He was always in the company of his lover, the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, if not all of Christendom, who had been the wife of the decrepit Botaniades, and also wife to the emperor before him, Michael the 7th Ducas. It was this erstwhile empress, a foreigner by birth, who devised the grand scheme, who set the pieces in motion, and who did not rest until the deed was done. Without Maria of Alania, there is no Alexios. In order to fully appreciate how much his improbable rise depended on her benisons, and how my own modest accomplishments would have been impossible without her inestimable influence and exemplary example, we must speak in greater detail of Maria, whose life, it must be said, is just as worthy of an epic as was my father's, if not more so. She is given short shrift in the Alexiad, and I must use the requisite pages to correct this oversight now. Before we commence that discussion, however, there is one last detail in the story of my birthday that I must relate. It is a purient detail, and I disapprove of purience in all its forms, but I feel that full disclosure is necessary here, as this detail illustrates more than any discursive editorial I might proffer the dynamics of the relationship between my father and his comely lover. You see, Alexios was not pacing when the daft astrologer made his fateful entrance in the map room.
That is a fiction I invented for purposes of decorum. No, adding to his humiliation, the old fool caught the emperor and his lover in flagrante delicto. There lay Maria upon the lush divan, her fair legs splayed, her pretty head cocked back, and there was the mighty Augustus on his knees before her, lapping at her fountain like a thirsty mongrel. A gorgeous icon of the Virgin Mary hung on the wall behind the divan, smiling radiantly and chastely upon them. At 32, Maria of Alania was already an old woman by then, 5 years his senior, twice divorced, with a young son of her own, ruined beyond ruination by any conventional metric, and yet still as alluring as the fairest courtesan half her age. As soon as the door to the map-room was shut and they were again alone, my love-drunk father, with nary a thought to his wife or his new-born heir, fell prostrate before his lady, and in that base position, unbecoming his high office, resumed his obscenity. "I did not release him," Maria told me later, one of many secrets she was to reveal, "until my desire was satisfied." Maria, maker of emperors, Maria, mother of my betrothed. Maria, who raised me, who loved me as her own. In the convent all these years later, when I offer prayers to the Mother of God, no matter the radiant countenance of the icon before me, the face of the Virgin Mary in my mind is the face of the Empress Maria.
Thanks for listening to this excerpt from Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay, by Greg Oliard. The preface and first chapter were read by Allison Weller. The music is called Sad Eyes by Dar Golan. Empress is available on September 18th, 2022 on Amazon and at better bookstores everywhere. Thanks for listening.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.